Please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm James Laughlin, and I am here on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Hernandez. And with the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of my time.
Counsel, please be reminded that the time shown on the clock is your total time remaining.
Yes, thank you. The district court committed multiple procedural errors when it imposed a sentence far above the advisory range for Mr. Hernandez's illegal entry sentence. First, it failed to announce its calculations of the offense level and the resulting advisory range. That error is significant because the range actually bounced around a lot in the various filings that were done by the probation office and the parties leading up to the sentencing before everybody finally agreed on a 10 to 16 month range. So that created a very real possibility of confusion and creates circumstances under which this court can't simply assume that the court used the correct range without it saying so.
First of all, he had some familiarity because he did get into the calculation of the criminal history category. So it was clear that he had something before him as to the proposed range. But more importantly, didn't he make crystal clear throughout that he was not interested in the guideline range because he felt that this recidivist had not been specifically deterred and needed an appropriately high sentence? And wasn't that crystal clear from his comments?
Well, I think there's two things that are relevant to Your Honor's question. The first is that to the extent that the government points to statements that the court made about the prior illegal reentry sentence of 30 months being a factor, that actually is a significant error in that a sense that it suggests that the court used that as a starting point and initial benchmark rather than the range. But even if it didn't do that, and even if it did have some concerns generally about recidivism or DUIs, because the ultimate 30-year sentence was so far above the range, it was three times the low end, almost twice the high end, the duty to explain is more than, I think this is inadequate. It's, why is this inadequate? Why don't the guidelines adequately take these factors that I'm stating into account? And the bigger the degree of variance from the guideline range, the more significant the explanation has to be. And here, what the court pointed
is
to-
right? Is that right? I mean, I thought there was that case called Booker where the guidelines were held to be advisory only.
They are, but post-Booker, the Supreme Court held in Gaul, and this court repeated it in Cardi, I think it said something like, it's beyond question that a greater variance calls for a greater explanation than a within-guideline sentence or a small.
Maybe I missed something, but didn't he in effect say, look, and repeatedly, this guy got 30 months previously, and it didn't do the trick, and he came back, and I'm not going to give him less than 30 months now because we need a sentence that will have a specific deterrent effect. Are you, supposing he had said it in those words, are you saying that you would then have a ground for reversal?
I think so. I think that would eliminate the initial question of whether he used the guideline range at all. But I still think that when the court points to the things it pointed to here, it's incumbent upon him to say more than that kind of generality about why, for example, the prior illegal reentry sentence. That resulted in a four-level increase in the offense level and a one-category increase in the criminal history category. So that by itself already was taken into account by the Sentencing Commission and vastly increased the range that would otherwise have applied. Same thing with the DUIs. Those were part of the criminal history calculations. Now, could a court in certain circumstances say, as the court did even in the pre-Booker era, you know, this criminal history, the guidelines calculations underrepresents a criminal history. It can, but it requires more than what the district court said here, and I think even more than what Your Honor, you know,
said. Why would it require more? If putting aside, which is not an issue here, that it's hard to know how the Sentencing Commission arrives at any particular guidelines, how they add 2 points here, 4 points there, picking it out of a hat, so to speak. But putting that aside, if a court says, in my hypothetical, I'm aware that the guidelines recommend a lower, but I am obligated under Section 3553A to look, among other things, at specific deterrence. And if ever there was a case where specific deterrence hasn't worked, it's this one. That's why I already said no to the earlier deal that the parties presented me with. And I think the absolute minimum that is required for specific deterrence is 30 months, because he got that before and it didn't seem to do the trick, but we'll give it to him again and maybe it will do the trick. If he had said all that, and I obviously acknowledge I am going well beyond what the record said, but this was, I think, a fair reading of the sense of it. Why wouldn't that comply with all Ninth Circuit precedents?
Well, I think that would probably comply with the procedural requirements of explaining the sentence and taking into account the guideline range. But as we argue in the briefs, we think that this sentence is, if the court gets past the procedural errors, we think this is a substantially unreasonable sentence, which means that in our opinion, and for the reasons we stated, that this sentence can't be justified by any court given any reasons.
Counsel,
and I think that,
yes? Were any of these reasons raised to the district court? Were any of these objections raised?
There was no objection to the failure to state the guideline range or the failure to state reasons. So as we acknowledge, the plain error generally applies unless the court wants to follow the 11th Circuit and find that at least failure to explain is de novo.
But under our precedent, we're on plain error review, correct?
Yes, but as for the reasons I think I stated in the briefs, I think that's easily satisfied under this court's precedents in WAC 9, as I explained in the reply brief. I think this is a very similar combination of errors that in totality should make the court conclude that it can't have enough confidence in these sentencing proceedings that it can affirm even under plain error review. I see that I'm hitting my 2-minute mark, so unless the court has any further questions, I would reserve the remainder of my time.
It appears not. We'll hear from the government.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Solomon Kim on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, in this case, based on undisputed facts, undisputed sentencing recommendation, and an undisputed guidelines range, the court chose to impose a sentence of 30 months, which was 6 months higher than what parties agreed was the appropriate sentence in this case. Under these circumstances, Your Honor, the court did not commit reversible error, and if this court were to remand for resentencing, the defendant would be subject to the same sentence, if not higher sentence.
Counsel, you don't dispute that the district court failed to articulate the guidelines range specifically at the start of the sentencing. You don't dispute that, do you?
We don't dispute, Your Honor, that the district court did not explicitly state the guidelines range. That is correct, Your Honor. We also don't dispute that the district court did not say, for example, that 8 plus 4 minus 2 is 10, offense level 10, criminal history category 3 results in a guideline range of 10 to 6 months. That is correct, Your Honor.
That's generally what happens, though, at sentencing, though. I was a district court judge before I got on the Court of Appeals. And so generally we start with, you know, the guideline range is this, here are the objections, here's the final range, and then you go from there. So why didn't that happen this time? Is that generally the practice for this court, or was this kind of an anomaly?
Well, Your Honor, in terms of what the court did in this case is that if you actually look at one of the very first things that the court did, specifically starting on ER 5, is that the first question that the court clarified and acknowledged was regarding the offense level. Specifically, the court stated that or asked the parties if the offense level or the guidelines included any adjustment aside from acceptance of responsibility. And the reason why that's so critical is because up until this proceeding, every single submission by the parties, the pre-sentence reports, had included a minus two early disposition fast track adjustment for the offense level, which resulted in a lower offense level. And so one of the very first things that the court did was to clarify that the offense level in this case was not proceeding based off of a minus two early disposition. The next thing that the court did, starting between ER 5 and ER 8, was that the court, as Judge Rakoff noted, went into detail to discuss not only the defendant's prior criminal convictions, but also specifically noted that the defendant's criminal history category was a category 3. And then at the very end of the sentence at ER 11, the court actually came back and specifically stated that the guidelines range was insufficient because it did not provide enough deterrence and did not provide enough protection for the defendant, which is exactly why the district court was actually varying upwards and imposing a sentence.
But never said what the guideline range actually was.
That's correct, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. But I think that goes back to the point that the government was raising earlier, that under the plain error review, the defendant has to show a clear and obvious error. And I think in this case, the defendant has failed to show that. And specifically, I think defendant relies a lot on Wachneen. And I think Wachneen is critically distinguishable on two points. The first point is that when the district court, when the Ninth Circuit discussed Wachneen's alleged error of the district court to fail to announce contemporaneously the sentencing guidelines range, in Wachneen, the district court, prior to actually imposing the sentence, did not reference the guidelines range at all, whether it was in numbers or whether it was a reference to the criminal history category or to the offense level. In fact, the very last thing that the district court did was that simply on the prosecutor's clarification question about how the court had arrived to its conclusion, the district court simply clarified it was a midpoint range based on him criminal history category of 1. In this case, as we just discussed, the district court, the very first thing that the court did was to clarify the offense level of the adjustment of responsibility being the only adjustment, then went on to the criminal history category, and then ended with a reference to the guidelines range. But the larger, I think the more important part that distinguishes case from Wachneen is that in Wachneen, when it came to the reasonable probability of the prejudice prong, even though the court held that the district court had erred on three separate grounds, that A, the district court did not contemporaneously announce the guidelines range, B, the government was not given an equal opportunity to speak, and three, the court did not mention any of the 3553A factors at all, the court still said in Wachneen that this was a close question and that, quote, a total failure of the court to do any of those things was the only reason why the court was finding that there was prejudice to the defendant. In this case, even if you assume that the court erred in the first regard about failing to contemporaneously announce the sentence, we don't have a failure by the court to, for example, articulate the 3553A factors. And I think the critical point here is that the court was aware and the parties were aware of all these undisputed guidelines range and the recommendations. So there's really no reasonable probability that the sentence would have been any different. And I think, Judge Rakoff, you touched on this point, which is that the prior 30-month sentence, which this court can consider because Cardi and Carter and his progeny talk about considering the record as a whole. What do we know about the court's rationale when we look at the record as a whole? And we know that the court was very concerned about the fact the defendant had previously been imposed a 30-month sentence, yet had continued to return and commit additional crimes. The court did not in any point during the sentencing hearing even remotely reference that as its only initial benchmark and make that 30-month sentence as its lodestar, which would, of course, be something that would be an error. But the court, as articulated by Supreme Court precedent and so forth, is allowed to start with the guidelines. But of course, post-Booker, these guidelines are only advisory. And a 30-month sentence, that the fact that it was previously imposed, can be a basis for the court to impose a greater sentence because the prior 30-month sentence did not allow for sufficient deterrence to the defendant. So in terms of the first issue, Your Honor, I think there's no reasonable probability that the court would have sentenced the defendant had the court uttered the magic words that 10 to 16 months, again, which was completely undisputed, was the guidelines range. And of course, Cardi is clear that it doesn't require the courts to utter sort of magical words in order to be in compliance with the law. In terms of the second issue, Your Honor, I think that's even clearer because despite the even assuming that the government did not have an equal opportunity to speak, the court was well aware that the parties and everyone essentially agreed on a sentence of time served. Had the court given the government additional opportunity to speak, the government simply would have said, as it was saying earlier, that given the time that the sentence, excuse me, that the length of sentence defendant has already served, the government is recommending a sentence of time served as agreed upon by the party. And so during the sentencing hearing, specifically at ER 8, the court was already aware that the parties were jointly recommending a sentence of time served. So had the district court allowed the government to explain further its recommendation, it would not have resulted in a different sentence because the district court had been made fully aware of the party's recommendation. In terms of the issue of 3553 factors, I think Judge Rakoff touched upon this. I think the court provided sufficient enough reasons. And the defense counsel points to the degree of variance from the guidelines range and argues that that required an additional explanation in this case. But I think Cardi also talked about the complexity of the case and whether or not that requires an additional explanation. And in this case, even though the defendant had multiple DUIs, deportations, and so forth, the nature of the defendant's criminal history was not very complicated at all. It was the fact that he basically came to the United States illegally and continued to commit additional crimes. And in that case, I think the court provided more than sufficient enough reason to talk about the deportations, the recidivist nature, the prior DUIs, to support its conclusion that a sentence of 30 months and the guidelines range of 10 to 16 months was insufficient in that regard. So I don't think that the court was required to give any additional explanation on that point.
One point that your opponent raises in terms of the inadequacy of the explanation is the district court's failure to address the mitigating circumstances, I guess, that were raised in the sentencing papers. Maybe you could just touch on that briefly.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I think the case that I would point to in regard to that question is Carter. And Carter, I think, and Cardi both made clear that the court is not required to explicitly reject the defendant's mitigation arguments or non-frivolous arguments. And in this case, the court did in fact reject the defendant's mitigation arguments, albeit in shorthand, which is permissible under Cardi, Carter, and also Trujillo. Specifically, if you take a look at the ER 8, the court made it clear that it was rejecting the party's sentencing recommendation of time served. And the sentencing recommendation of time served was based in large part, at least by defense counsel's arguments in the district court below, on the mitigation arguments concerning the defendant's mental deficits. And it's clear based on the record, the court was well aware of this because it had presided over the competency hearing, said that it read the report very carefully, that it was quite extensive, and that adopted the findings, and then was reminded of those findings in the party submissions and also the PSR. And so by the time that the court actually went to impose its sentence, it simply weighed the factors, undisputed factors, just differently. And it said that it was not going to go with the party's recommendation, which again was based on the mental deficits of the defendant. And so I think that's a clear indication to the court, albeit in shorthand, rejected the defendant's mitigation arguments, even though it was not explicit. I see that, Your Honor, I'm a little bit over time. Unless the court has any additional questions, I'll submit on those arguments. Thank you, Your Honor.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have 3 points. First, with regard to counsel's description of Walk 9 or Walk Mean, I disagree. If the court looks at page 554 of that decision, the district court in that case did say it was using criminal history category 1 and was using a mid-range sentence. But then this court went on to say, but there was no contemporaneous announcement of the calculated guideline range. And that was one of the factors in the totality cumulative error analysis that ultimately led to a vacating the sentence. The second point with regard to Mr. Kim's statement about ER page 8, where the court supposedly rejected in shorthand the mitigation arguments based on my client's mental infirmities. I strongly disagree with that because, I mean, in fact, I think his argument highlights why an explanation was required, because the government actually disputed those mental infirmities. They interpreted the report differently than we did. And so that was a very significant dispute that called out for an explanation. And I don't think you can read that single line as even the shorthand rejection of this non-frivolous argument that's required under Trujillo. And then the final point is that Mr. Kim mentioned he's mentioning the joint recommendation of the parties, but he ignores that in addition to that, the probation office recommended a low-end sentence of only 10 months. And in its letter justifying that, and this is at the sealed sentencing documents at page 11, it has a detailed explanation about why that it thinks that sentence is inconsistent with the 3553A factors, including that his criminal history, as reflected in the guidelines calculations, is adequately takes everything into account, and because his intellectual disability is a mitigating circumstance.
All right, so, thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel for your helpful arguments. The case just argued is submitted for decision by the court. The next case.